5.5 minutes, the universe expands 4 miles. And every time I blink, another child enters the world. The world has 6.5 billion people this year. And there are 8 million people in this city, on this island, but right here, right now, somehow you're sitting.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, January 23rd, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic at TalkinBroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Matthew.
Hi, James. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to be back. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his work at followspotphoto.com and also read him at npr.org, as well as Broadway Stars and a few other outlets. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Michael and Matthew saw Other Desert Cities, written by John Robin Bates, off-Broadway. Michael, what did you think of that?
Well, I guess I didn't like it as much as a lot of the other critics did. I thought it was a very interesting effort. The play's by John Robin Bates, and I guess to me, I would say that he's better at themes than at dialogue. To me, his dialogue doesn't always ring true. It always sounds kind of not the way people necessarily speak. It is a very interesting premise. It's about a woman who writes a sort of tell-all memoir about her family, including the apparent suicide of her brother, one of her brothers. But then there's lots of revelations and twists and things like that, and the cast is really quite amazing. It's Stockard Channing. And Stacey Keach, who I actually think this may be the first time I've ever seen him live on stage, and he was pretty extraordinary. Elizabeth Marvel is the central character, the one who writes the memoir, and Thomas Sadowski, who was so great in Reasons to be Pretty, and Linda Lavin, who needs no introduction. So one of the best casts you'll ever find, and this is at the New House at Lincoln Center. And yes, I do have the impression that it was generally very well received and certainly a worthy, very interesting effort. But to me, it just seemed a little contrived and not entirely successful. But I'm still very happy I saw it. And I would recommend it for the acting alone, which is extraordinary. And much of the writing is really quite excellent. So it's definitely worth a look.
All right, Matthew, what'd you think?
It's interesting because I don't think I even liked it as much as Michael did. I think it's a really tough idea for a play, and there are a couple of reasons. I've talked before on the podcast about how I don't like really sort of one-dimensional, simplistic kind of moral or political discussion, you know, play. I've talked on the podcast before about how I don't like plays to have really simplistic, one-sided moral or political discussions because I don't think it makes for interesting theater. And that was the problem that I had here. The idea is that the mother and the father are Republicans, conservatives, whatever, who basically disowned their eldest son because he basically turned into a hippie and was protesting the Vietnam War. And what Michael said is right. That's a really interesting idea, especially since the play is set in the mid-2000s. It's set 30, 35 years after all this stuff happened. And whether or not any of the people involved look old enough to actually have had any of that stuff go on in the time frame they specify, I'm going to leave alone. But the problem that I had with it is that the characters are all – Well, Stockard Channing and Stacey Keach, who play the parents, seem very sort of by the numbers in terms of their construction. I didn't really believe them. It really seemed to me like they were just sort of constructed to be sort of the bad guys who are going against, you know, what the good things that the smart daughter and Linda Lavin want. And that doesn't make for interesting conflict to me. I wanted to really know more about them and why they felt the way they did and what sort of led them to the conclusion that their cause was more important than their family. And again, I probably could have put up with it too, but toward the end of the play, there's a twist that happens where you learn that they aren't even really that much into the cause. And for me, that really just sort of deflates the entire thing, and it makes the entire play pointless because they threw away one of their children's lives and they ruined what was left of their family over something that they didn't even believe in. And that really sort of thrusts the entire sympathy for the play onto the Elizabeth Marvel character, which to me was another problem because I didn't really buy her argument to begin with. I actually was siding with the parents. And they kept saying throughout the entire thing to Elizabeth Marvel, listen, we understand you felt the need, you had to write this, you've had some problems, depression and all that. We understand that we would like to ask you to respect us and to respect our friends and respect what we've done for them and for the country and just wait until after we've died to publish this. And she's like, no, I really am not going to do that. I need to do it now for me. And I thought that was a very selfish attitude. And to me, the play wanted me to believe that the parents were the ones who were being selfish, and I just didn't think they were. And that really made the play very difficult for me to swallow. And the other thing is that Michael's right. This is a fantastic cast, but I had issues with almost every single one of them for different reasons. Now, I mean, if you go back and you listen to some of the podcasts that we did in 2009, I was a huge fan of Thomas Sadowski and thought he was just spectacular in Reasons to Be Pretty. And I stand by that. But in this, he played a very kind of flat version of the character he played there. Here he's a television producer who's using his job as kind of a way to escape from having to deal with certain issues with his family. And I just felt like he wasn't really giving me a vibrant, exciting personality. And Elizabeth Marvel is really wonderful at conveying conflicting emotions, as she's demonstrated time and time again in off-Broadway plays. But here, she always seemed to lean toward the anger too much. And I felt like it was always really a very kind of selfish sort of, hey, look at me, I'm being angry kind of performance. And Linda Lavin and the other two quote-unquote adults in the story, they were really, they were doing their best, but it all seemed to be kind of familiar work from them. I wasn't getting the sense that these were really new characters rather than just ways that these established performers with established personalities were falling back on their old tricks to just sort of create people that would work with a script that didn't give them a lot to really sort of work with. And so I found it really very unsatisfying in a lot of ways. But what the one thing I have to give credit to is John Lee Beattie. He devised a magnificent set for this. The play, as the title sort of suggests, takes place in Palm Springs, and he's got this beautiful, elegant living room kind of set that has palm trees outside and looks like, you know, everyone's idea of a summer paradise. It just so happens that the play is set, you know, again in Palm Springs around Christmas time. So there's that aspect of it. And I really like the idea that he was taking us to kind of a different sort of magical place that doesn't really compare with New York in the winter. But I guess I wanted John Robin Bates and the actors to go somewhere that's just as far flung. And for me, they didn't.
Your point about the anger is well taken, Matthew. And that made me think of something that actually annoyed me in the play, which is also the case in many of the plays of Eugene O'Neill and some other great writers. In this play, the people in the family say some incredibly awful things to each other. And then 45 seconds later, they're sort of forgotten it and saying how much they love each other. Now, I don't know. I mean, I think that people in families actually do sometimes say really terrible, terrible things to each other. But when that happens, I don't think that they tend to recover immediately. I know certainly that's my own experience. So that always bothers me when I see that in a play, and it just kind of takes me out of it. And that happens several times in this play. There are incredibly weighty issues discussed and accusations made and throughout the play. And then 2 seconds later, you know, somebody's just kind of handing somebody a cup of coffee or whatever. So I don't like that. One other interesting thing about the play is that we are told that this brother who killed himself did so by jumping off of a ferry. And of course, I guess it's got to be an intentional reference to Spalding Gray's suicide. So that was something that I definitely thought was interesting. I don't know if John Robin Bates had a relationship, any kind of, you know, friendship with Spalding Gray, but that was a very telling moment to me.
All right, so that wraps up Other Desert Cities. We've talked over the last couple of weeks about A Small Fire off Broadway, but Michael finally got a chance to see that. Michael, do you want to weigh in with what you saw there?
Well, again, it just seemed to me that there were some wonderful moments in it, and the premise, again, is extremely interesting. It's about a woman played by Michelle Pauk, who's very much in control of her life, and she's a construction manager, I guess, and she's got people working for her, and her family is very dependent on her in one way or another, and then she suddenly begins to lose her senses, literally, one by one. So that's fascinating, isn't it? But it just seemed kind of a messy play with characters there who didn't need to be there and characters not there who should have been there. Celia Keenan Bolger, plays the daughter, and there is constant reference to Matthew. Remind me, it's her fiance, right?
Yes.
Yes. Constant references to him, but he never shows up. And I know that I and the person I brought to see the play, we were both kept saying, "Well, where's the fiance?" It seemed like he should walk on at several places and kind of join into what was happening. But on the other hand, there was this character played by Victor Williams, who works with Michelle Pauk's character at the construction site, and he seemed to be there for no good reason. And suddenly, in the middle of all of her drama, there's this discussion of AIDS brought up. It seemed like that was that character's raison d'etre, and it didn't seem to me to belong in this play. I don't know. It goes with the feeling I have in a lot of plays I've seen, and I keep saying this, but I think it's true that sometimes I get the feeling that writers start more than one project at a time, which is certainly understandable, and sometimes they conglomerate them, because I've seen several shows where it seems like some of the themes in the play didn't necessarily meld with some of the other ones, and the same with the characters. So that was my feeling here anyway, especially in terms of that character played by Victor Williams. I don't know what he's doing in this play.
All right. Matthew, any retort to what Michael has to say?
Not at all. I've talked about a lot of these issues on the podcast before, but I do just want to point out that what I observed the first week that we talked about this has basically played out with the various discussions about it, because Michael and Peter and I all had rather diverse reactions to the show. And really, we all saw the same script, and we saw it on different nights, which makes a big difference. But this really is one of those plays that just sort of divides people, and depending on your experiences and what you want from a play and what you don't want from a play, it can make a big difference. I think that it's either closing very, very soon or it's closing now. I'm not entirely sure how much longer it's running, but it's a fascinating idea for a play. And Adam Bach, who's the playwright, is certainly one of our kind of up-and-coming talents who will be heard a lot more from in the years to come. And certainly Michelle Pach and Reed Burney and Celia Cannon-Bolger are terrific performers. So they're another good reason to go and see it. But I would love to hear what anyone else thought about this place. So if you've seen it, give us a call or email us and let us know, because obviously it's one of those plays you cannot easily pin down. And for better or worse, I think that that's sometimes a good thing, because it gets people talking, and talking is a good thing about theater, even if it's about Spider-Man.
Yeah, I agree certainly that Bach is extremely talented playwright. And one more thing is that for that reason, I wish he had not ended this play with a very long, extremely graphic sex scene between Michelle Pach and Reed Burney. Because as I've said in the past, if you have a play that has a very graphic sex scene or a very graphic nude scene, a lot of times it is often an indication that the play itself is not very successful on its own, and that this scene is thrown in there just sort of for shock effect and to, you know, kind of make the audience think that, you know, something really amazing is going on. So I mean, how do you all feel about really graphic sex scenes on stage?
Well, Michael, for what it's worth, I agree with you in general. I think that Adam Bach was smart here, because he didn't try to continue the play afterward, because I don't know where you go from that. My problem with the sex scene in this play, and I don't know how to discuss this without spoiling the show. So really, if you if you're going to see this, or you don't want to spoil, miss the next 30 seconds or a minute or so of the podcast. But it bothered me, because the entire point of the sex scene, as I saw it, was that she may have lost all of her other senses, but she can still feel. But the problem is that was never a concern, because it was established very early on that she was still able to communicate by touch. So to me, the sex scene was really sort of, it was dealing with a topic that they had already established, and it wasn't adding anything new to the story. I realize the point is, as Peter said very smartly last week, that yeah, she may have lost everything, but there is still something left. That's a very nice point, but it's not one that had gone unmade by that last minute in the show. And as I said the first week, Peter, as I said the first week, Michael, I think one of the big problems with the plays is that it's only 80 minutes long, and he's trying to tell such an involved emotional story in such a short period of time that I think he was trying to use the sex scene to sort of telescope 20 pages of dialogue into one 2-minute thing, and it doesn't work, because that kind of thing never works.
Well, yeah, you know, I agree with you, but I guess I really object to it. I don't want to sound like a prude, but I don't know that actors should be made to be put through that, especially if it's not really important to the play. Which I think it almost never is.
Is it different for film than it is for stage?
Well, I do think it's very different to me, because of the circumstances of, you know, how many people are watching when a film is done, and it's so much more technical apparently when you do a sex scene in a film, and I really object to it.
Yeah, Michael, I'm not sure I necessarily object to it, but I totally understand where you're coming from. Jeffrey Sweet, who is a playwright that James and I both know from our days on Rec Arts Theater Musicals, he has a wonderful book out there called The Dramatist Toolkit that I would really recommend to anyone who's interested in playwriting or dramatic writing of any sort. And in that, he says that the problem with nudity on stage is that every time you see it, you can't help but thinking, wow, the actors are naked. You don't think about the characters. And that, to me, is the problem here, because it's all about Reed Burney and Michelle Pach. And again, to me, it might not have been so much of a problem if I really felt that was a step that the characters needed to take. But so much of it was accomplished in dialogue. Their relationship was shorn up through other things that happened. It was already established that she's dependent on touch and is really coming to see that as being more than the sum of her other senses parts. And then to have that dropped in there, it did seem kind of gratuitous to me. I don't know if it necessarily always seems as much so as it did here, but yeah, I think that is a problem here, as in most plays. And I would have liked to have seen a different solution to it, but I think that this is a play where there could have been a lot of different solutions to a number of the other problems. So,
well, have you ever seen it work in a play? I mean, the opening, of Passion or maybe the Full Monty or something like that.
I was just trying to think. The only one I can think of offhand where I felt like it was really necessary to the story maybe was Spring Awakening.
And even there, though, it was pretty well obscured. The same thing in the Full Monty. I mean, yeah, Jonathan Groff did sort of open up Lea Michele's top or whatever, yeah. But it wasn't really gratuitous. They weren't like trying to show stuff. They didn't have, you know, Michael Mayer didn't have her turn out front or anything. No, it was nothing like that. And in the Full Monty, of course, the big deal at the end of the show was made of them getting naked with bright lights in the background, so you couldn't really see anything. Now, I didn't see the original production of Wicked off Broadway, but that's an example that I've always heard people say that's like the one time they thought the nudity was acceptable. And that it wasn't in a sexual circumstance, which I think makes a big difference, but that is something that people say a lot, is it didn't bother them and it was really necessary to convey something about the lead characters. So I think nudity maybe can be used correctly, but I think a lot of the time it isn't.
Well, yeah, but also, I mean, I think there is a big difference between there's nudity and then there's graphic simulation of sex on stage. And it's the second one that to me almost always seems like just a quick, easy way to make an effect and not usually well advised and something that actors really should not be asked to do.
You put it in the title, like Naked Boys Singing or Puppetry of the Penis or...
It's funny, maybe we'll talk about it more later, but this play's coming to Broadway titled High, in which Kathleen Turner plays a nun who's, I guess, a drug
recovering
counselor.
Yeah.
Yes, and she also, I guess she does like interventions for other people. And this is by Matthew Lombardo, who has not had a great deal of success lately with plays like Looped. But this play is coming to Broadway. And, you know, guess what? Apparently there's a rather lengthy full frontal nude scene by a young male actor in the play. So, you know, maybe that's one thing you have to do to get your show produced on Broadway.
Hmm. Well, Kathleen Turner certainly did it in The Graduate.
Yeah, that's a good point.
For what it's worth, I don't think that's really necessary, but yeah, that's too bad. I want to reserve judgment. I don't see, you know, how that could just sort of come naturally out of that particular story, but whenever, we'll see.
Well, that may come naturally or not, but my point is that, you know, that is something that I think has been proven to sell some tickets, and if it's obviously, if it's just in and of itself, if it's there for that reason, then that gets really sketchy. You know, it's not like it's Equus to me, which is the prime example of a situation where the nudity is really essential to what's happening in that play, and you're so involved in the story at that point that the thought of going to Equus to ogle someone, it just, I don't know, it doesn't really occur to most people, I think. That's not what it's there for.
Talking about Kathleen Turner coming to Broadway in High, we also have other shows who are starting to announce their intentions for the 2011, maybe 2012 season. We see on It Must Be True, because it's on Perez Hilton, that Ricky Martin is coming in to do a Vita with Elena Roger.
Yeah, James, I didn't think this was news, actually. Hadn't this been announced quite a while ago?
Well, I guess now they have dates.
Dates. It's becoming more firm. I mean, the Ricky Martin thing had been talked about, but not mentioned in a long while. And, you know, it's starting to seem like this is all firming up, and this is that revival that started in London with Elena Roger, who's actually from Argentina, isn't she?
I believe she is, yeah.
And got great reviews over in London, and Ricky Martin is going to join her on this side.
But James,
he's a very good singer. He's done Broadway before, so.
What did he do on Broadway before?
Les Mis.
Les Mis.
Oh, that's Marius.
Right. That's right, yeah.
Maybe they'll give him the Mistress's Song, like they gave it to Madonna in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He could sing both sides of Another Suitcase in Another Hall. So
I love that song.
Yeah, it's a great. That's a great song.
Yeah.
I didn't hear with the London Revival. Did they take any of the adaptations from the movie, or did they just do it straight the way that it was before? Did you guys hear either way?
You know, I'm not sure, but I don't think they did. There wasn't that much different in the movie. There were those new lyrics to that song, "The Lady's Got Potential."
Yeah,
that was a big change.
I didn't really enjoy the movie, and I really loved the musical. I didn't really enjoy Antonio Banderas, and I didn't enjoy Madonna. What's your opinion? Did you guys see the movie? What do you guys think?
I actually did like the movie.
Me too. Yeah. I mean,
it's a different. I mean, it's a true adaptation. They do a lot of things, like they cut down the Art of the Possible to a much smaller number, yeah. And they added in that new song, and they kind of just cherry picked things from different versions of the show. But I thought that what they did actually made a very good kind of cinematic telling of it. I understand the problems that people have with it, but for me, it worked.
I'm not talking about the body of the work. I didn't think it was good casting.
Well, she was certainly not the best choice for the role, but but they probably wouldn't have made it with anyone.
Listening
else.
To last week's podcast, probably not as bad as Barbara Streisand and Gypsy, huh?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. Alrighty. So that's coming, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that. As it gets closer, Matthew sent around a clip of a Ragtime video that's on YouTube. A school production, a high school production, was it, Matthew? That was doing Ragtime with a white Cole House and white Sarah, and it's getting a lot of play. And it's interesting, the kids who are in the production are defending it on YouTube and saying, we really love the show and we don't have any black people in our school. What do you guys think about that?
To me, one of the most shocking things was in the comments section, one of the students replied defending it, because people are over it. And she said, "We tried our best." Since she spelled tried, TRYED, and she spelled our, ARE. And I wrote, God, do they teach English in your school? I mean, isn't that shocking?
Unfortunately, it's not shocking, which is a whole separate thing.
Yeah, when email and texting and Twitter and Facebook and all this started to become so popular, I foolishly thought to myself, well, maybe this will lead to a renaissance of the written word, and maybe it'll lead to people learning how to spell again and use correct grammar. But no, it's just not an issue. People just write whatever comes into their head, and they don't think twice about whether it's spelled correctly or grammatically correct.
Yeah. Matthew, what did you think about not quite the spelling, but the video itself?
I have to pass along a comment. I got this from someone else and sort of passing it along to people. And I got to pass along the comment that I saw in the thread. For those of you who know Ragtime, it's kind of a literal interpretation of "there were gazebos and there were no Negroes." It's really, listen, I love Ragtime. I really do. But I think that because of the racial content of the show, and I want to be clear about that, because I actually don't mind non-traditional casting in circumstances where race doesn't play a role in the story. I don't necessarily have a problem with, say, a black Harold Hill, or I guess if you're doing Thoroughly Modern Millie, a white Muzzy or something like that. I mean, there are lots of examples. I mean, name your favorite show. It doesn't matter, as long as it's not about race. Because when it's about race, the fact that some actors are white and some actors are black, or some actors are Asian or whatever, becomes a part of the story. And without that aspect of it, the story itself is meaningless. And having a white Cole House or a white Sarah in the show, I think they even had a white Booker T. Washington. The entire show is, an important plot point is about how Tata can sort of quote unquote pass, because he can make himself into a baron that he's not really, because he's he's white, and that's something that Kohlhaas couldn't do. It's integral to the story that there be conflict because of people's skin color. And when everyone on stage is white, that I think that that causes a huge problem. And it's funny because from the same guy or person who uploaded the ragtime clip, they did Showboat the following year. And there's a clip of a white Queenie singing, you know, the black dialect in Queenie's Ballyhoo to a bunch of white people who then run screaming up to the balcony to go see the – I mean, it's terrible, and it's completely against the point of the show. I understand that these schools might not want to – you know, do the traditional slate of shows, but there's got to be a better solution than this, because I mean, what's next? An all white Raisin in the Sun or something? I mean, you can't. There has to come a point where you say no, or you find a school nearby that has a better
race. Exactly.
Do the show with them. I mean, yeah. There's just got to be a different solution to this than this, because this is really embarrassing. I think.
And we should point out that it's a 2008 production. We're coming on 3 years ago, and so this is not new, but it just seemed to have gone viral on the internet, and lots of people are talking about it. Do we know the show? Where? What school it was? I don't see it anywhere in the. It was posted December 5th, 2010, but they don't say what school. They just say. It's a high school production of Ragtime.
Oh, so the show was in 2008, but somebody just posted the video?
Just posted it, yeah.
Well, I don't know. Yes. I mean, I personally think that colorblind casting doesn't work in almost all cases, but yes, it certainly points up when it is in a situation like this where race is at the very core of the meaning of the musical. It just kind of points out how it doesn't really work.
Yeah. Matthew, did you want to talk about Joe Turner's Come and Gone?
Well, I just wanted to update on the issue that we talked about last week. They're going ahead with that show up in Connecticut. They I think the school board overrode the decision by the superintendent to take down the show, so they're actually doing it. And I think that's a great thing, personally. It's interesting because that's an example of a school that did have, you know, the proper racial makeup to do a show, and they're still kind of fighting their own battles about getting it on. And really, I guess if school is going to do Ragtime, the Waterbury Arts Magnet School would probably be better than the one in the YouTube video. But I don't know if that high school is in Connecticut. Maybe they could get together and do a production of Ragtime or Showboat that would look proper. So I don't know, but I'm glad that the school board up in Connecticut came to its senses and is doing Joe's Turner Come and Gone. It's interesting because my understanding is that the school board only kind of relented. My understanding is that the school board only relented and decided to go ahead with the show because now they're partnering with the Yale Repertory Theater, which of course has a really long history with August Wilson. They developed a lot of his plays and certainly have played a lot of them there. And so the kids are really going to get a wonderful lesson in not just how to put on a show and even not just in the meaning of Joe Turner's Come and Gone, but they're also working with a major theater company that did these shows the first time. And so it's going to be a wonderful education for them from a lot of standpoints. So I think that this is going to end up being a win-win for everybody. And if it ends up being a good production, it will be a good thing for the audience too. So good going. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get up there to see the show. I'm afraid I'm actually probably not going to be able to, but I certainly hope it turns out to be good, because they have they've overcome an obstacle, and it seems like they did it the right way. So,
yeah, it's an interesting story there, and I guess the superintendent of schools or one of the executives that runs the school there said, you know, we don't know what side to err on, to be politically correct or unpolitically correct, because we're going to get protests on either side when it happens.
But, you know, as I think we said last week, James, why don't they just, you know, to me, it seems so simple, the solution. Somebody could come out before the play and make some kind of a statement about context, you know.
And well, Michael, that's what they had planned to do. And that's what's happening now with the Yale rep, is that the Yale rep is sort of organizing a talkback series with people from there. So that is going to happen. And that's a good way to go, again, because it's educational and these kids are going to school to learn things.
Right.
Not to have the opportunities be taken away.
Stop. Right.
So I did at the top of the show joke about missing last week. I was away with my family in Florida. But you guys talked about Spider-Man and what was happening with pushing back the date again and how unbelievable it was and should it be reviewed or not. And one of the things that was being talked about was how the reviews would not be as impactful if they were spread out over a month versus coming all in one day. And I just wanted to weigh in and say that that even though the reviews might start now and continue through the official opening date, I think that every media source is going to either send somebody back again when the show is quote-unquote frozen or rerun the review on the date anyway, because nobody wants to be one up by the other newspaper, magazine, website, television show, whatever media form that the reviews are going to be done. So I still think you're going to have an onslaught of reviews on that day. Did you guys mention that and I didn't hear it, or?
No, I think you're right, James. And yeah, I guess that hadn't actually occurred to me. I mean, the thought was that the effect of the reviews would be diluted because they'd be coming out in dribs and drabs. But I do think you're right that even people who do go see it earlier, that they will either rerun the same, well, I guess they couldn't rerun the same review, but they will probably go back again and there will be lots and lots of reviews that appear on whenever the official opening is.
Yeah, the other thing is and actually Michael Riedel talked about it, I had been thinking about it for weeks, is that this extension and extension and extension of the preview period and its impact upon the actors. I think Riedel wrote a story about the actors trying to figure out, you know, how to get compensated for rehearsing during the day and performing at night that they don't normally do as heavily as they are doing right now once the show opens. Did you guys talk about that last week with Riedel's column?
No, we did not talk about that.
But yeah, that's, you know, I'm not quite sure they're doing 10 out of 12s. 10 out of 12s means that they're on call for 12 hours and they have to work for 10 out of those 12 hours and they get 2 hours, usually an hour for lunch and an hour for dinner. And that's a really grueling schedule, and most actors really hate it when we go into 10 out of 12s because it's exhausting and you never seem to get caught up with your sleep. So there's really not a huge amount of Spider-Man news that's happened this week. We did hear that that they've agreed to put the word preview on the tickets and various other ways to notify the public that they are still in previews, which is fine. And there was also talk that there's a new ending where Spider-Man flies at the end. So I guess, you know, they're doing some work. I also heard that Bono left. Did you guys hear that?
Wasn't it someone reported that he was here briefly and then he'd left not long after.
So I can't really confirm that. I just heard that in passing that Bono was not going. But I guess the various informal reports that we're hearing are that the problem is really with the structure of the book and not quite the music yet. The some of the U2 fans fan sites have done reporting on it already at least the U2 fans are happy with the genre of the U2 music that's in Spider-Man, and certainly they've sold enough albums to say that that's at least adequate. So,
by the way, I did confirm with someone that Reef Carney is a nephew of Art Carney, or a grand nephew. It's not he doesn't seem to be you know, trading on that in any way.
Yeah.
But I just think that's interesting. You know, that's Art Carney is kind of a really famous person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny how a talent stays in the family.
He's not a blood relation, I should say, but he is. I mean, Art Carney was his uncle through marriage.
Okay. So yeah. Also happening this week, Theoni Aldridge, who was a famous designer, passed away. And the lights on Broadway are going to be dimmed on Tuesday. You guys have anything to say about Theoni?
Well, she had a pretty great career. I mean, even if you pick particular shows, you know, you could pick like any five shows that she did and it would have been enough for a career. Things like like A Chorus Line and
Annie. She did Annie.
Annie, the original Lacage, which was kind of amazing. Dreamgirls. A lot of shows. 42nd Street, Barnum, Ballroom. Really, really incredible.
That's great. You know, and it shows the wide range. She's, you know, it's not as though she was just known for a period look or a contemporary look or something like that. She ran the gamut, and she really made everybody look great up on stage.
She did the original Two Gentlemen of Verona, too.
Yeah.
She worked really a lot for about 42, 43 years or something like that. So she had a really amazing career. Yeah.
It's a great Broadway career.
And she was her husband was the wonderful actor Tom Aldridge, who is still with us.
Great voice.
Yeah.
Michael, you want to do a preview of your interview with Chuck Cooper and Ted Sperling?
Oh yeah, I'd like to mention a few things. It's really quite apparently a total coincidence. What are the chances of this happening? Within the space of 2 weeks, we're getting concert revivals, major concert revivals of two very obscure Kurt Weill shows, Knickerbocker Holiday and Lost in the Stars. And not only if that isn't enough of a coincidence, both of them have lyrics and book by Maxwell Anderson. And they are the only two shows that Anderson wrote with Weill. So that's kind of amazing. but anyway, the Collegiate Chorale is doing Knickerbocker Holiday this week with for two performances, and the cast includes Victor Garber and Kelly O'Hara and Ben Davis. And then the following weekend, Encores is doing Lost in the Stars with Chuck Cooper and Patina Miller, and a really great cast there too. So that's, I mean, this is an incredible opportunity we have to see these shows done with full orchestras and with talent like that attached. So get yourself to both of those if you can. That's my advice.
Yeah, I'm a huge Kurt Weill fan, and really, I don't think he ever wrote anything bad. But certainly, there's excellent scores in both of these shows. Knickerbocker Holiday is one that might really surprise people because everyone knows September Song from that. But I mean, really, there are a lot of excellent songs of that, and it's a very different style than Lost in the Stars, which is very dramatic and very sort of tribal in the way that it develops. But the thing about Kurt Weill is really every show he wrote sounded completely different from every other show he wrote. So you could never say Kurt Weill just wrote this or that. He wrote everything, and really, you've got a great opportunity the next couple of weeks to see a sort of period musical comedy and something that's a bit more experimental. So it's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the range of the man. Knickerbocker Holiday is set in New Amsterdam, and one of the characters is Peter Stuyvesant, and it's apparently like it's really almost an operetta with a, you know, kind of a corny sense of humor that would be one way to describe it. And Lost in the Stars is about apartheid. Isn't that incredible? It opened on Broadway in 1949, and it's about apartheid. I mean, what a stunning thing that is, isn't it?
Yeah, You know, it, you often wonder if art shapes culture or culture shapes art.
Well, Chuck Cooper said that he said the show is stunning, really bold and brave. Certainly the evil of apartheid was something that deserved to be put under a microscope. The theater at its best can shed light on issues like that and cause us to take a look at ourselves and make improvements. All things are connected, he said. So I think Lost in the Stars was probably one of the kernels or seeds that helped bring about the end of apartheid many years later. It's amazing that they had the balls to do this show, that they raised the money to do it, and that it was received so well.
Michael, when is your interview going to run?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow on Broadway Stars? Or?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. All righty. Also, we want to wrap up. We're going to talk very briefly about a project that Matthew had a little bit of knowledge on. The Kerrigan Loudermilk new CD is out, and Matthew wrote the liner notes. So, Matthew, tell us from the inside. Tell us about this new CD, and maybe we'll play some music on it in the intro and out.
This is the first CD that I've ever written liner notes for, so I would have been excited anyway. But I have been a fan of Brian Loudermilk and Kate Kerrigan for over 6 years now. In the very first New York Musical Theater Festival back in 2004, they had just a spectacular musical back when he was like 21 and she was maybe 23, 24 or something like that. It was better than most things I've seen written by people two or three times their age, called The Woman Upstairs. I've talked about it on the podcast before. It was about a physics professor and a blind violinist who get together and have all sorts of issues. But really, wonderful show. I keep hoping that you'll see it again somewhere. I keep hoping that it will show up again somewhere, but it hasn't yet. But really, they're amazingly talented people, and they do something that you always hear composers and lyricists and book writers talk about these days, but you don't really see very often. And that is, they really capture the voice of a younger kind of generation of people. They focus primarily on people who are either going into college or who are coming out of college and trying to find the kind of bridge between childhood and adulthood, right as that point in life when everything that you thought you knew about how to live is changing. And I think that the songs that they have in this recording, which is called Our First Mistake, really capture that in ways that really show off the depth of their writing. I don't really know what all to say about it, but there's one song from The Woman Upstairs here called 5.5 Minutes, which was originated by Kate Schindel as the kind of mentor to the physics professor who's singing about all the cosmic kind of forces that came together to lead her to be in the same place as this woman that she's in love with, was there with a different man falling in love. And there's that probably the closest thing that Brian and Kate have to a famous song right now, just Run Away With Me, from the unauthorized biography of Samantha Brown, which it was just announced is going to be at Goodspeed Opera House this summer. It's sung by Michael Arden. It's a terrific song. He's just absolutely great singing it about this young man who's in love with this girl who's about ready to go off to college, and he wants her to give up that and to basically just sort of go on a long road trip with him across the country. And it's a very powerful song about something that a lot of us feel or have felt but don't ever really hear expressed. And that's what they're so great about doing. They take things that we all think about but rarely express because it doesn't seem like it's quote unquote musical. But I mean, time and time again, that's what they're good at. They have a couple of songs here from something that I wrote about on Broadway Stars a few years ago. It was their musical that was inspired by two college students who were going off to college for the first time, leaving their homes and the cities that they had grown up in. It's called The Freshman Experiment. They have two songs there that really capture the sort of heartbreak and the confusion that happens when you do that. So I am completely biased, and you need to take that with a grain of salt. And as I mentioned, it's my first time writing the liner notes, so I would be excited for people to read this anyway. But I think it's a tremendous disc, and it really it just shows these two young writers at really the beginning of what's going to be, I honestly believe, and I would say this even if I hadn't written the liner notes, a remarkable career. So I pick it up. It's on Shikaboom. Or you can download it from iTunes. It was very funny last week. It came out on Tuesday, and they kept updating all day on Twitter as the album kept moving up the various pop charts. And I think it got up to like 14 or 24 or something like that on the composer list, and it got up in the top 50 for the day on the overall iTunes list, which I think is pretty amazing. So. They have a strong following, and I think that when this recording gets around and people hear more of what these they're able to do, kind of melding traditional musical theater style with more current pop music forms and giving each its fair due, not really letting either one alienate fans of the other, I think they're going to earn even more fans. And I think that this is really the start of something big for them. And I'm happy for them, and I'm happy for the musical theater that they are writing for it.
That's great. And you said that you've been following them for about 6 years or so. How did you first get acquainted with them?
As I said, I didn't know anything about them before I saw The Woman Upstairs. Like a couple of people I knew, I kept saying, "Well, you gotta see the show. I know these people. They've written it. It's really kind of amazing, and I think you'll like it." And it's one of the rare cases where people said that to me about a show, and they turned out to be absolutely right. And I got kind of addicted to their work after that. I wasn't the only person, apparently, because right after Woman Upstairs came out, there were a number of concerts and readings and stuff that just sort of started popping up, and I was very privileged to be able to see some of those, and I got to experience kind of a broad range of their work. James, when you and I were at Stage Directions at Lifestyle Media, I actually interviewed them about in 2006 for our annual musical theater issue and talked a little bit about them then. But I just sort of got to know them through various journalistic channels. But mostly I've just been a fan of their shows because they always write interesting stuff. They've had one off-Broadway musical, which was an adaptation of a children's book series about called Henry and Mudge, and they have had two shows at the New York Musical Theater Festival, Woman Upstairs, and then they had a Choose Your Own musical called Wrong Number that was set in Boston. It was very, very original. It was a little bit rough. I saw it the first night, and I guess that they had some problems there, including the ending where Boston got blown up and no one was quite prepared for it, and that kind of had an interesting series of things happen there. They have a concert series going on right now that's hitting a lot of the kind of big New York cabaret spaces and giving people even more opportunities to be exposed to their music. I went to the opening night last week at the Laurie Beachman Theater. A few songs that have been heard before, but a lot of new material too. So even if you think you know their catalog and you're in the New York area, you might want to check out the tour because you're going to get to hear a lot more of it, including stuff that they had just finished writing like earlier that day or something. So you never know. They're always working, and they're always coming up with really exciting new ideas for stories. And as much as I still want to see The Woman Upstairs produced somewhere, I think that any opportunity to see and hear what Brian Loudermilk and Kate Carrigan do is well worth the trouble.
All right. So before we go, I just want to say that for the last couple of weeks, there's been an empty space, at least in my heart, with Talkin' Broadway's All That Chat message board has been offline due to a really large hacker attack against the website. We hear that All That Chat is hopefully going to be back this week, but we encourage everybody to go back and rejoin the conversation there when the board opens up. And also, if you are in a position and you really like All That Chat, Talkin' Broadway's undergone a lot of extra expenses to get the site back up and running, so they're taking donations on their front page as well. So please, if you do feel that way and you have the ability to make a small donation, you know, $5-$10 would be great to get that site back up and running for everybody. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right under that, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new podcast, It'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes. As Matthew aptly pointed out last week, iTunes is not the only place that you can get this recording. You can also get it in the Zune Marketplace. You can get it through Stitcher Radio, Stitcher Radio. You can also get it through Google Listen, or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio 3 times a week. We are on Broadway World Radio. Let me look it up. I thought I had it in front of me. I don't. Here, Wednesday at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. My God, for a former actor, I can't remember anything. I can't remember any of my lines. You think I've done this a million times. So, yeah, that's how you can listen to us. If you'd like to contact us, say hello, comment on something that we've said, good or bad, otherwise, you can go to the front page of BroadwayStars.com and there's a contact form, or you can give us a call at 646-873-7695 and leave us a voicemail. And if you do leave a voicemail, we can play it on the podcast, or we may play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who will be back next week, he was on assignment this week, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
I'm just saying there might be a life here, a new one, as soon as we run, just as soon as we run, run away.